We have been studying situations of difficulty, the specific context of chapter 1, in fact, the specific context of the entire book is dealing with temptation, but quite frankly, any difficult situation becomes a temptation. We are faced with the responsibility of making wise and godly choices, but particularly difficult things, as James talks about in verse 2, the various trials that we come into, the variegated difficulties. And in our studies so far, we have had James set before us the awesome possibility of an enormous joy after the judgment seat of Christ that should be the focus of our decision making. We should always be making our decisions based on what we want Jesus to be able to approve in that day. We are supposed to make those decisions knowing in verse 3 that the testing of our faith produces this thing called endurance, which is the ability to stay in a situation regardless of how difficult it becomes until God provides the way out that He's promised. And in verse 4, we're supposed to have this objective of being mature and complete and realize that this entire process of facing difficulties is a part of how that works. Now, last time in verse 5, we said that verse 5 was probably the least believed verse in the book of James because it comes across as a very clear covenant commitment on God's part to give plain wisdom without embarrassing or humiliating us. If we ask for wisdom, if in a situation we don't know what to do, we're supposed to, according to this verse, ask God for wisdom to know what to do, and He makes this promise that we will have that wisdom. And people say, yeah, well, I'm not real sure about that. And we pointed out last week that God doesn't say here in His Word how He will communicate that. We're going to be discussing that a little this evening. But one of the things that James does do in verse 6 is he goes further and insists that our asking be done in faith, without any doubting per se. We're going to look at what that means. Because the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. That man, according to verse 7, shouldn't expect that he'll receive anything from the Lord because he's a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways, according to verse 8. So this evening, what I thought we might discuss and interact with is this requirement that we ask in faith without any doubting, because of some of the things that Jesus Himself said in some other places that have bearing on this. Before we get into the particulars, I'd like to just remind you that the context of verses 6, 7, and 8 about asking in faith is a context that is basically a context of instability. He uses the idea of the one who doubts like the surf of the sea or the waves of the sea. They have no anchor. They move as the wind blows, and as they're agitated by the currents, they are driven and tossed. There is nothing to anchor them. They have no stability. And then in verse 8, he comes back on that theme of instability and says that a two-souled man has this problem of being unstable in all his ways. And so that's the basic context of our thinking about asking in faith. We want to try to delve into that a little bit this evening and see what it does mean to not doubt. Now, one of the things that I want us to do, there are three verses that I would like for us to look at and read. So I'm just going to ask three of you to look these up. I want somebody to look up Matthew 17:20. Somebody else look up Matthew 21:21. And then I want somebody to look up 1 Corinthians 13:2. Floyd, have you got Matthew 17:20? Would you read it for us?
Then he warned the disciples that he should tell no one he was the Christ.
Is that 17:20? I've got the wrong verse written down.
I got
16:20. Oh, I'm sorry.
Jesus answered and said, "O unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring them here to me." 17. I read 17:20.
All right, now read verse 20. Okay.
And he said to them, because of the littleness of your faith, truly I say to you, if you have the faith of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible to you.
Okay, now in this context, the disciples have not been able to cast a demon out of a boy. Three of the disciples have been with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. They come down off the mountain, and the other disciples are in a brouhaha with some people. And this man had brought his son to them to have him cured of his demonic possession, and they couldn't cast the demon out. And so Jesus casts them out, and they say, why couldn't we? And his answer is verse 20. The New American Standard has the phrase, because of the littleness of your faith, but probably the King James translation is better there, because of your unbelief. The idea of littleness of faith and then saying if you had faith as a mustard seed seems almost contradictory.
Right. Well, I've got a feeling you're misinterpreting this thing on the mustard seed. A mustard seed is small.
Uh-huh.
But a mustard seed has no doubt. I'm thinking it's of the faith of the mustard seed, not the size of a mustard seed.
Well, okay.
The mustard seed just does what God wants it to do. It grows and produces a mustard seed.
Yeah, but his point in pointing out the mustard seed is that it's such a little seed. Now, let's go on over to chapter 21.
Jesus replied, I tell you the truth, if you have faith and do not doubt, not only can you do what was done to the fig tree, but also you can say to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea, and it will be done.
Okay, now in chapter 17, he said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. And in chapter 21:21, he says, if you have faith and don't doubt, you can say to this mountain, be plucked up and cast in the sea, and it will. Okay, Lou, 1 Corinthians 13:2.
If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing.
Okay. Now, there are three texts here that deal with this matter of being able to move mountains. The first one tells us if we have faith as a mustard seed. The disciples couldn't cast the demon out, but Jesus said, hey, if you had faith as a mustard seed, you could say this mountain, and it'd move. The problem here was you weren't believing. If you had been, you could have done it. And then in chapter 21, he just point blankly says, if you have faith and don't doubt, you can say this mountain, be plucked up and cast to sea, and off it goes. And then Paul turns around and almost seems to contradict it. The translation Lou has there doesn't give us the import of his words, because he says, if I have all faith so as to move mountains, and he implies it takes a great deal of faith. So who's right, Jesus or Paul or, well, both of them, and it's our responsibility to get it figured out, okay? These people that are always wanting to find contradictions in the Bible, we need to understand the Bible is accurate. It's our understanding that is lacking, and it'll come together if we give it some thought. So let's do that. When we talk about Jesus in Matthew 13 had said that the kingdom of God was like a mustard seed that was smaller than all of the cultivated seeds. But when it was planted, it grew up into a large tree, and all the birds of heaven came and built their nests and stuff. So his point in talking about mustard seed business is that it's so small, and yet it has within its essence the capacity that God has packed into this little tiny thing, that when it's planted and functions, it grows a tree bigger than all the rest of the garden plants. And Floyd's right in the sense that it does what it's been designed to do. But my point is, that's what faith is designed to. If faith is exercised, the results are automatic because God says so. If you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, the result will happen. Why is that? Because what? Go ahead. The power of God is behind his word, and faith is confidence in what he said. So when we believe what he says, He is therefore free to do, and omnipotence is behind what he said he'd do. So when we trust him, it's the power of God, the omnipotent power of God, that's available.
If we haven't had anybody that I know of that said that kind of faith, haven't seen any mountains jumping into the ocean.
Well, it's never happened in the history of the world. So what we have to understand is the point that Jesus is driving at, and that is that if faith exists, if genuine faith exists, even if it's this much what is prayed for or what is said or whatever, will be done because the omnipotence of God is behind it. However, that seems to raise a problem in both Matthew 21 and James 1:6 when he says, ask in faith, nothing doubting. Now, how do you put that together? How is it that you can, on the one hand, have Jesus saying to his disciples, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, it'll be done, and then turn around and have James say, well, your faith, though, has to be nothing doubting? Thank you, Floyd. Well, I want us to understand that there is something going on here that I think is real exciting if we get our teeth into it. So let's just go through this the way he gives it to us. Let's go back to Matthew 17 for a minute or a few minutes. This is why we never get anywhere in James. But the issue is raised by James 1:6. The question is, how do we ask in faith without doubting? How do you do that? Well, I think part of the answer to that is to go back to where Jesus himself, and James, by the way, got his information from Jesus. So Matthew 17 gives us some very interesting insights. What I want to ask in the first place is what the disciples had in Matthew 17 that did not constitute a mustard seed faith. Well, let's start by looking at Matthew 10:1. You don't have to turn there. I'll just tell you what it is. In Matthew 10:1, Jesus mandated his disciples, gave them a commission to go and preach the gospel, and he told them, as you go, heal the sick, cast out demons, raise the dead, and so on. He also said, don't go to any of the cities of the Gentiles, but just stay in Israel. So there is a dispensational element in that. But my point is, Matthew 10 was in the same disciple setting as Matthew 17. So one of the things we know they had that did not constitute a mustard seed faith was a divine mandate. They were told by Jesus to cast out demons. Well, the assumption of the command is that the power comes with the commission. You can do it because you've been told to do it. And I think that's fundamental to our whole approach to the issue of exercising faith in what God has said. If he tells us to do something, the assumption is the capacity to do it comes with the commission to do it, with some understanding of the ministry of the Spirit and some other things. But the point is, he never gives us a command he doesn't expect us to pursue the fulfillment of. Not in our own strength, but nonetheless, he doesn't give us commands that he doesn't expect us to pursue the fulfillment of them. So the disciples had this, but this in and of itself did not constitute mustard seed faith. They couldn't do it even though Jesus had told them to. Now, the second thing that they had is illustrated way before Matthew 10, and so I'm not going to give a specific verse, but in the general issue, they had a human commitment. And what I mean by that is they were willing disciples. They'd been following Jesus around and had been part of the big group. And then when Jesus went up on the mountain and prayed and sought the wisdom for the disciple choosing process, he came down off the mountain and he called the 12. He didn't have to twist any of them's arms. There wasn't any indication of any reluctance on their part. he said, I want you and you and you and you and you and you and you. And they all said, all right. Because to them, he was Messiah. And to be selected by him for the special inner circle group meant the best places in the kingdom. That's a, all right, I want to be there kind of response. They were willing. They wanted to do this. He didn't have to twist their arm. And when he sent them out to cast out demons, it says they went out and did it, and they came back about this high off the ground saying, wow, even the demons are subject to us. And they were floating. So this human commitment is, you know, today we beg and plead and cajole and try everything we can, you know, to get people, won't you just please give Jesus a chance, that kind of stuff. We just beg them because we know what's happening. We know where they're going if they don't and all that. But the plain fact is, these men were willing, they were ready, they wanted to do it, they were in there and they were doing it. But that did not constitute mustard seed faith. Because when they were confronted by this demon, they said, come out. He said, I ain't going to do it. And they said, what do we do now? I mean, they'd never run into that before. Every time before, they said, come out of him. And the demon would do whatever he'd do, and then he'd come out. And they'd run into, you know, they hadn't run into any. They've been doing this. We don't know how long, but we do know that they were with Jesus almost 7 years. So they've been doing it. They had, in fact, that'll be the third thing that we'll put up here. They had a backlog of success stories. They had a personal history of knowing the technique, if you want to call it that. They knew how to do it. They had a divine mandate. With the word comes the ability, at least in some sense. They had an enthusiastic human commitment. And they had been doing it. It always worked before. So, what's the problem? Well, Jesus says, if you'll accept my appeal to the King James text rather than the New American Standard, Jesus says, because of your unbelief. If you had had a mustard seed faith, you could have said to a mountain, get out of here. And it would have... So casting this demon out of this boy shouldn't have been a problem. But it was. Why? Well, because the demon said, no, I ain't going. Why didn't he have to go? Well, Jesus said, it's because of your unbelief. Where does unbelief come into here? What's missing? Well, I want to suggest something. You may not buy this. And I don't care. I like it. If you don't buy it, you can explain it your own way. But in verse 19, the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why couldn't we do it? Now, why didn't they just ask him outright? Well, I think they'd already been humiliated. You see, the disciples had been out on these preaching tours, and they'd been raising the dead, casting out demons, healing the sick. And the people had gotten used to the fact that you didn't have to have Jesus around as long as his disciples were there. So here Jesus was gone. Where he was gone, we know, but they didn't know. But they had come to this group that they recognized was the majority part of Jesus' disciples, and this man brought his demon-possessed son and said, heal my son. And they tried, and it didn't work. Now, how do you suppose they felt? They were humiliated. They were embarrassed. If you ever wanted to say, God, you let me down, I'm sure they were thinking this. What are you trying to do to us? You give us this commission to go do it, and then when we command the demons to depart, they say, I ain't going to do it. And there's nothing we can do to make them. And I think that's why in verse 19, the disciples came to Jesus privately. They'd had enough of the humiliation, of the public embarrassment. But what does that tell you about them? Yeah, shows they're human, but what does it tell you about their motivation?
Looking for the glory themselves.
You know, I think that this is the real key. The issue in Matthew 17 is that the disciples, I believe, had shifted in focus, or in perhaps we should say in motive.
They were doing it on their own.
And not only on their own, but for their own exaltation. Well, they had the command, they knew that. And they had had all this success in the past, they knew that. And they were willing, that wasn't their problem. I think, though, that the former successes had probably gotten them some pretty high recognition. And they liked that. That's one of the biggest dangers of ministry, is people looking up to you, patting you on the back, saying all these nice things. You get to where, kind of like that. But as soon as you start moving in that direction, what is your motive now for ministry? See, before, the motive for ministry was to obey Jesus. He said, do it. The motive for ministry was to be a disciple. And when they went out wanting to be Jesus' disciples and be obedient to his commission, they were successful. But then, when it got routine and they had gotten into this business of being looked up to, I think that their motive changed.
Peter was told, you're a stumbling block for me and you're setting up your mind on guidance, but the man
uh-huh.
over in 16th
chapter. So. That early, huh? Yeah, it is there. I really believe that at this point in the disciples' development, they were struggling at the motive level. They were no longer of that enthusiastic group who were doing things because their motivation was to be good disciples of Jesus. Now, their motivation is use the power of God to exalt yourself. Now, they'd have never been that crass. They'd have never said that, and so many, well, maybe they would. You remember Jesus said, what were you guys arguing about on the way? And they wouldn't tell him. But they'd been saying, I'm the greatest in the kingdom. No, you're not. I am. No, you aren't. I am. You know, that sounds like a bunch of children. But they were doing it. So apparently the disciples all had a fairly significant weakness in the area of ego gratification. They wanted to be somebody. And apparently at this point in their ministry, Jesus had decided that he was going to bring that out. So when they commanded the demon to go, somehow the demon knew, the power's not there, I don't have to. And he said, I ain't going to do it. And then the disciples discovered the power was gone. Where did it come from? Well, it came from Jesus. Where did it go? Right back to Jesus where it came from, I suppose. But what we conclude then is that mustard seed faith has these things plus a legitimate motive. Now, what is a legitimate motive? Well, we can start by saying it doesn't have anything to do with us. My motives, if they're focused on me, are illegitimate. That's always the truth, always the case. If my motives are focused on me, that's selfishness, and that's an illegitimate motive. If my motive, however, is on somebody else, it may be legitimate. If it's focused on Jesus Christ, then it is legitimate. Now, let's look at, in relation to that, look at James chapter 1. Look what he says in this paragraph about asking in faith, nothing doubting. He says the real problem is in verse 8. the New American Standard says is a double-minded. But that's dipsoukos. It's two-souled. Now, you know from the studies of the covenants that the issue of the soul is security through relationship. That's the soul's focus, or it's supposed to be. What is the most common perversion of that? Security not through relationship, but through what? Money. Materialism. The biggest problem that people have in relation to this security thing is that they're afraid the relationship won't cut it, so they go to plan B, which is money. Now, no Christian ever gets free from being two-souled if his focus for security is here, because every believer has a gut level, built-in, automatic, bottom-line desire to please the Father. The Spirit brings that in when he comes in crying, Abba, Daddy. And so every believer has a desire to please his Father, but he also has some other desires that compete with that. And being two-souled simply means that I have a way to achieve what I want, and I can do it this way and this way. It's just a divided loyalty. Well, isn't that what having a legitimate motive or an illegitimate motive is? Isn't that what it's all about? Is divided loyalty? So what I'd like to suggest is that a mustard seed faith, and the reason why mustard seed works is God never requires us to be mature in the faith in order for him to work. He only requires that we believe for him to work. If he had put it on some other basis than mustard seed, well, then we would have to believe, and then we'd have to grow in faith until we finally got enough faith, and then we could get God to do things. But that's not the way the scriptures present it. Jesus says, mustard seed, honest, genuine faith will always motivate God to act. Always. He never rejects legitimate faith, no matter how minute it is or how great it is. Now, we're almost out of time, and we haven't even begun to cover the issues here, but I want to ask this question. What then does Paul mean in 1 Corinthians 13? If I have all faith so as to move mountains and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. What's he suggesting? Beats me. No.
Love has to be a motive force too.
Yes, but he implies that God will respond to all faith even if I don't have love, even if I'm improperly motivated. Now, how do you put that together? I'll tell you how I do it, and like I said, I don't care if you do or not. This is how I put it together. I hope you interact with this enough to where you can put it together in a way that is pleasing to God and satisfies your heart and mind. But it seems to me that the scriptures say God responds to faith at his discretion if the motive isn't good. In other words, if you're gifted as an evangelist and you do the work of an evangelist and you depend on the commission that God has given you as an evangelist, and you get involved with somebody's wife on the side and nobody knows it, you still go out and you preach your evangelistic sermons, people still come to know the Lord. I have often pondered, how can God do that? Well, the reason is he can do it at his discretion, even when the motives are really lousy. But I'll guarantee you this, he won't put up with it forever. Sooner or later, he's going to pull the plug on you, and you're going to be humiliated, and this sin that was hidden is going to be brought out and shouted on the housetop, because he said he'd do that. But that doesn't mean that God won't use a person who believes even when his motives are wrong. Floyd?
Mm-hmm. Paul said, some preach Christ this way, with, some another way, but
right.
As long as Christ is preached.
Yeah, he rejoiced that Christ was being preached. What I want to get, though, is this. When my motive isn't right, according to James chapter 1, verse 7, I have no basis for expecting that God will do anything. But he still does sometimes, at his discretion. Calvary freed God up to do whatever he wants to do. At his discretion, he can do as he pleases. But if I believe him, he will respond always if my motive is legitimate. Because at this point, if my motive is legitimate, God's got to do what he said he'd do, or he's a liar. Now, obviously, God did not say that he was obligated to do anything when my motives are wrong. In fact, James says that. You ask and receive not, because you ask amiss, that you may consume it on your own lust. God is not obligated to do anything when my motives are wrong. But when my motives are right, as he defines right, and I believe what he said, he will always respond. Because he has to, or he's a liar. That's why Jesus said, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, then suddenly God's omnipotence is committed to his integrity. And since he's the one that said it, he's the one that'll have to do it if you trust him, if you believe him. A grain of mustard seed. So the grain of mustard seed is everything that would normally be considered faith plus the legitimate motive. This is not really faith, but it's generally considered to be that. If God has said it, then you have a foundation for faith. If you're willing, you have a foundation, you know, for it being done. If you have history of success in this, well then, but typically you got to be careful at the motive level. If you really want God to be involved and not just at his discretion. Let me see if I can wind this up by saying it this way. If we were preaching the gospel, we could say this. God has promised that we will find him when we seek him with all our hearts, hasn't he? The Bible says, whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved, doesn't he? He makes all kinds of these kinds of things. Well, the plain fact is, I wasn't looking for God when he found me. Now, he did say, if I sought him, I'd find him. I wasn't looking, but I found him anyway. Why is that? At his discretion. Now, the point that I want to make is, when I have all faith so as to move mountains and have not love, I may be depending on what God has said and all of that with a wrong motive. Sometimes, many times, God will still, at his discretion, he'll still do. If he waited for us to always have the right motive, he'd be waiting a lot. But if we really want to be plugged into what he's doing, the faith that we must exercise is a faith that has a pure motive. It's not two-souled. It's not split in its loyalties to what is going on. And the real issue here is, what do I really want? And the answer had better be the will of God for me. I don't necessarily want out of my pain. I don't necessarily want out of my bad relationship. I don't necessarily want a good reputation. I don't necessarily want a reputation in the eyes of people. I want the will of God for me. Because that's what God wants for me. As long as I'm on his wavelength, that's what I'm going to get. Because he doesn't respond at his discretion when faith is exercised with a legitimate motive. He simply responds with his power. But if we throw a kink in it by having a bad motive, I'm not positive that the disciples always had good motives when they were casting out all those demons. I don't think they just woke up that morning and decided to have a bad motive that day. I think it had been creeping up on them. But Jesus had decided, we're going to nip this in the bud today. And when he did, he withdrew the power, and the demon said, I'm not leaving. And there they were, hung out to dry. And then, why didn't it work? And it was a good teaching experience for them. Okay, we're out of time.